It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Joey Loss.
We are full housed today on this beautiful Pi Day. I want to welcome everybody to Pi Day. It's 314, and I've read a little bit about how that got started this morning, and it was, I think, in Orlando. Guy started it, and he was given some kind of a tour and feeding people pie and trying to get his whole concept of Pi Day going, and it took
hold. I remember in high school they'd do a Pi Day competition.
Oh, really?
They would see how many digits people could memorize.
Do you know what the world record is?
I'm gonna guess it's real high.
You better think
much higher than I know.
It took 16 hours. Just to say the digits.
Jeez.
There were over 100,000 of them.
Oh, my. That's incredible.
Yeah, you got to really care to do something like that, don't you?
And have way too much free time. Let's be honest.
Way too much, unless he's winning some kind of a big prize. I don't know.
If there's a monetary reward.
Other things going on today. The people around here probably know it's tournament time out in Ponte Vedra. And that means there's a lot of people in from out of town. Some of them passed me on Butler on the way in, going the wrong way. I didn't try to turn them around because when you're going 90 miles an hour, you don't turn very quickly. Hmm. Just be careful out there, people. There are a lot of people here that don't know their way around. Have a little patience. I couldn't get out of Marshland this morning to save my life. And, you know, I don't blame people. I try not to get angry with people. Every one of those out-of-town people comes in here with their big, giant American Express card, leaves a bunch behind. That's a good thing. So I hope it stays this way through tomorrow. It's not looking that good, but that the TV coverage should be really good today just because the weather is so perfect. And the guys are killing it on the course, too. I haven't gotten a full leaderboard yet. But anyway, yeah, I always like to caution people on tournament week because it's easy to get frustrated when it's crowded and full of people that don't really know their way around. Anyway, enough of that. Welcome to all the regulars. I point out every week, if you keep listening, we'll keep talking. And we, so far, have reason to believe that's going on. So we'll be talking about all kinds of stuff today. I guess it's sort of the bright side of all the junk that's going on right now. It sure makes finding a topic easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been 3 or 4 months since we've had a shortage of things to talk about.
Yeah. It's the old thing where all the news writes itself these days. You just come in and sort of summarize it. So anyway, if you're new to the program or from out of town, we try to listen unless you arrive at your location. And try to listen for the whole hour. And we talk about anything you want to talk about. There's hardly a topic in the world that isn't related to money, and there's hardly a person in the world that doesn't have concerns with money. And not always because there's not enough of it, but there's things you don't know. So if you want to pick up the phone and dial 904-222-8255, that's 904-222-TALK. We will, of course, put you, as always, right up to the front of the line, talk about whatever it is you want to talk about. All right. That said, it wasn't a lot of fun this week, I would say. On the other hand, it could have been worse.
Could have been worse, for sure. It's a really strange market right now. The market is in extreme oversold territory. It's more than 3 standard deviations below its 50-day moving average, and yet we're just about 5% below an all-time high on the S&P.
Weird, isn't it?
That is so strange. This is not a situation that is seen very often, and to me it all is a direct reflection of the price of oil. The situation corrects itself in one of two ways. First, the supply constraints on the Straits of Hormuz could dissipate and the price of oil would fall, resulting in a stock rally. The other option is that oil prices could remain elevated and stocks could fall further, justifying the oversold situation and bringing down the 50-day moving average. So Obviously, I have a preference there, but it is not. It's not going to be up to us. It's going to be what happens in that part of the world, and I honestly can say I have no idea what's going to happen there next. This week, we saw the NASDAQ drop 1.3%, the S&P down 1.6%, and the Dow down 2%. Well, oil actually dropped from about $116 on Monday morning down to about $78 overnight on Tuesday, and then it climbed to end the week back to right around 100. So pretty volatile. The market's really having a hard time trying to figure out how to price oil with conflicting reports about Iran mining the Straits of Hormuz and attacking ships that pass through. The other thing is that is adding to the uncertainty of the stock market right now is that the 10-year yield has been climbing, as has the U.S. dollar. They call that trifecta the three-headed monster, and when all three are headed higher, it spells bad news for stocks. So keep an eye on those three things: oil, U.S. dollar, and the 10-year yield. On Friday, the fourth quarter GDP growth was revised down from plus 1.4% quarter-over-quarter growth to 0.7% quarter-over-quarter growth, a drop of 50%. This was largely due to the government shutdown. Actually, not largely. It was all due to the government shutdown, which cut the growth rate by 1.2%. Without that shutdown, the growth rate would have been closer to 2%. Purchases by the private sector actually totaled 1.9% on an annualized basis, so the private economy looked pretty solid. Additionally, that 1.2% drop in government spending really just got pushed forward, so it will show up as a tailwind in upcoming reports. So it's not like government spending doesn't go away, unfortunately, in many cases. It just gets moved. Consumer spending remains solid in the fourth quarter, showing a steady growth rate between about 1% to 3% over the last five quarters. After bouncing around wildly during the tariff announcements last year, consumer income also rose slightly in December, which may have contributed to a higher savings rate, which jumped to about 4% in January. The PCE report continues to show inflation hovering around 3%, while rent continues to drop in almost every month since early 2023. Now, rents aren't falling. That is just the rate of inflation that is falling. It's now running around 3%, down from over 8% in 2023. Durable goods inflation is running at 2.2% year over year, while services are steadier but higher at 3.5% year over year. Trueflation, our favorite new inflation indicator that looks at 35 million data points, shows inflation running at 1.51%. The JOLTS report also came out on Friday and showed slightly less job openings than last month, but a pretty stable job market overall. One area that was notably weak was the professional and business services sector, while the information industry hired the most people since 2023. That really flies in the face of the narrative that AI is destroying the computer programming industry that's been so popular on the news. And one bit of good news is that the Iran war has caused investor sentiment to decline, with just 32% reporting as bullish and 46% reporting as bearish. So, you know, they're always wrong.
That's funny. I think at the beginning of the year, we talked about how all 20 major strategists were super optimistic. They always overlook the potential for a geopolitical event.
Always, always.
And now that everything's negative, I'm feeling a little bit better about the one-year look.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about it, actually. Yeah. All those are being revised down now. Yeah. So.
Those are economics people. They call it the dismal science. Why? I don't know. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Joey Loss.
And we do have lines open, 904-222-8255. And we have a trivia question this week brought to you, as usual, by Paul Lloyd at First Coast Alarm. You can reach Paul at 904-636-7888. I want to talk a little bit about economic freedom today. It's kind of a big deal because it's being challenged in a lot of places around the world, including some right here at home. I was kind of surprised about the increase in economic freedom that's been shown in this country. for about the last 13 months, I would say, 13 and a half months. We're doing a bit better, but we're not in the top five. Four of the top five are Singapore, Switzerland, Ireland, and Taiwan. What's the fifth? No clues. What's the fifth best economic freedom country? And I'm spotting you one thing. It's not this one.
All right.
More on that in a while. All right. Do you want to wrap up anything else on
that
the market?
That was it. Joey, I actually wrapped it up there.
In particular?
No, I just want to reiterate the, you know, when we comment that a sentiment falls, our brain's forecasts go up.
Mm-hmm.
Adam, you want to share something like why that's the case? We call it a contrarian indicator. Why is that?
Because people and investors are reactive and the market is forward looking. And so people tend to get in bad moods when the market's going down and then get euphoric when the market's going up and want to put more money in. And that's the exact opposite of how a real investor should think. You want to buy low, sell high, but it's just so hard to do because we're just not wired that way.
Yeah. And we talk a lot about how geopolitical events, as serious as those events might be from a market perspective, they're not as enduring in terms of what we see from the market long term. So what they really do is just kind of turn people's attention away from fundamentals, which might be very positive, and create buying opportunities for longer term investors.
I have a little list here of things that changed in the last month. And I think you're going to be a little surprised. Labor market. The share of respondents reporting that they are unemployed and looking for work fell to the second lowest since April of 2022. Who knew? Housing. Home purchase intentions rose month over month, but remained down significantly from their 2024 peak. No surprise, the interest rates are not going down right at the moment.
They're
going up a bit.
Yeah.
Consumer sentiment, highest net percentage positive on the economy since September. Consumer activity, highest reading for discretionary spending intentions since 2022, and acceleration sequentially in spending and foot traffic. Personal finances, strongest sentiment toward personal finances since April of 22, drop in percentage reporting living paycheck to paycheck last month. Investor sentiment, sequential increases in general risk sentiment and stock market optimism, while negative sentiment toward crypto continue. And then there's one very interesting data point. The credit card balances on average are coming down. Less people getting into trouble on credit cards and more people making a dent in their credit card spending. I consider all of those pretty positive, and yeah. I think most of them feel kind of surprising in light of the news that gets shoved in our faces 24/7 these days.
What was the source of the? Who put that out?
That was from the Bespoke Consumer.
Yeah, I think it was.
Wow. They do their own polling.
Independent
researchers. They're very agnostic, so they just put out what they see.
Well, and for what they charge for their research, they better be pretty good.
Yeah, I hope so.
And they are. So.
Well, and they also put out a thing this morning last night that showed what the differences were between registered Republicans and Democrats.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a pretty wide spread in that data. But the averages were good, but it was definitely Republicans tended to be much more optimistic and feel better about most of the categories, and the opposite true for Democrats.
Hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, the polarized society is not going to heal itself because politics has reared its ugly head in far too many areas it doesn't belong.
And yeah,
there's one of the newsletters I get in the morning. I read a whole bunch of them on the computer in the morning, and I think it's Stiles, but I'm not sure. At the end of every newsletter, he's got in big letters, please stop taking politics so seriously. And I just want everybody to think about that because everything is politics.
Everything. It's so crazy.
And I'm kind of a conspiracy theorist and all that at heart and a real conservative. But come on, leave it alone a little bit. Trump didn't cause everything that's wrong in the world.
What?
Another comment I wanted to make on the market itself. There are traders who are basically speculators, and then there are long-term investors. You know what to do if you're a long-term investor, especially if you listen to this show very long. And we know that this too will pass, and it'll come bounding back. And by the time, if you're one of the capitulators, as they call them, the last event in a down market is capitulation. That's when mom and pop sell everything. And then they whine and cry, woe is me, what's happening? You know that if you watch things like odd lot sales. When the odd lot sales, meaning less than 100 shares, when that activity picks way up, watch for capitulation. The other thing that's important about it is that's when the market's going to turn. When the capitulation happens and people are putting money on the sidelines, you can bet, and you will generally win, that the market is about to turn up again.
One of the interesting things about the last few months, though, is in my career doing this, you know, a dozen years, it feels like the retail investors are getting smarter. They're just moving. There's a lot of rotation, but they're not exiting for the most part. I mean, you see, like right now, there's some rotation out of what's been hot for the last 6 months into oil because the traders, as you said, are trying to play that. But there's still not a ton of money just exiting the market as a whole. At least I haven't seen it.
No, I would agree.
No, I don't think the money market funds are growing at the same rate that you would expect if this is really happening the way we think it is. That you see one of the headlines on the bespoke thing, it said that the market is something like this. The market is so bad that nobody sells.
Yeah, it was a clever headline.
I go back to something I wrote for the newsletter years and years ago. Don't try to catch the falling knife. In a market that's this volatile, if you think you're going to time that downward so you can get out and then get back in, you're expanding your chances of losing a lot of money, period. Where if you want to just sit on what you've got, and I don't care if you move a little money around different sectors or whatever. People have good reasons to do it. Talk about it first, though. And then there's some idiots out there. And let's see. Here's one. Not hard to find an idiot in my stack of stuff. His name is Michael Hartnett, and he is with Bank of America. Now, a lot of you understand my feelings about big banks, and I think they're very justified. I personally would never use one unless I absolutely had to. He says that he thinks this is starting to feel like it's 2008 all over again. What do you think?
I think that sounds political.
You think?
I think it's political, but it's also like becoming trendy. I mean, he's one of a dozen people who started saying that over the last few weeks. But the things that they point to just don't satisfy me.
There's nothing
in comparison.
Yeah, there really isn't any like basis behind it.
The private credit shakeup that's going on is contributing to it. I think you're seeing more people say stuff about that, but it's just not a perfect parallel to 2007.
And I love how when people talk about the private credit situation, they then point to spending on AI infrastructure building, which A, is nowhere near the alarming levels, and B, is being done by companies with solid cash flows that can make the payments. So it just doesn't add up. Yes, there is private credit funding AI infrastructure, but there's really no problem with that in today's environment. They're speculating that the AI won't pay off and then these companies won't have cash flow to cover it. But it's complete speculation.
Anthropic's revenue has 14x'd in 12 months.
Exactly.
So, like, if that wasn't happening, I might be on that boat, but I'm not.
Yeah, there's no data behind it. It's just like, oh, look at this. This is a lot of spending over here. It could be dangerous.
One of the opening paragraph lines in the same guy, the Bank of America guy, says, private credit is the elder concern. Huh?
I don't know what that means.
I don't either.
I think maybe the utmost or the high ranking. I'm not sure what that means.
Two bankruptcies last year raised questions about the industry's underwriting standards. They're talking about private credit here. And my margin notes that I prepare early in the morning before the show say simply, who cares? I don't. You guys give a rip about private credit?
Yeah, I mean, I do. A large amount of defaults in the private credit market could have a disastrous effect on the economy. But the fact is, we're not seeing that.
No, we're not seeing that. And it does not equate to, just because you see the word liquidity attached to private credit, does not mean that it equates to the subprime lending practices that contributed to 2007, 2008.
Fact, couldn't be any more different.
Honestly. I also saw an article that was trying to make the case that when we see an increase in ARM usage, adjustable rate mortgages, that also points to the creation of a 2008 type scenario.
False.
We can talk more about that when we come back. But
I'm running out of time. We'll pick up on this right away. Another short break, and we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Joey Loss.
I remind everybody, lines are open, 904-222-8255. And the trivia question is still out there. The five countries with the freest economics in the world include Singapore, Switzerland, Ireland, Taiwan, and the answer to this question, if you get it right.
All right.
Back to my comments about Mr. Hartnett from Bank of America. He makes this observation that is just stunning. Gas prices have followed oil higher.
It's almost like gas is a derivative of oil.
Maybe that's it. Can I write him and tell him?
You should.
Okay. At $3.63 a gallon, gas is now 22% more expensive than the day the war began. And then Adam's comment to that was, but. It's still something.
Yeah, it's still not $5 a gallon.
No.
It's slightly higher, but there's a war going on in the number one oil producing area of the world. So that happens.
Well, he also says that rising oil and gas prices have revived concerns about stagflation.
I am so tired of this. I am too. It's so annoying. First of all, yes. Okay. I see where the inflation side of that argument comes from, but where does the stag come from? We're nowhere near that. Like, we've been seeing strong growth rates of 3-4%. It doesn't make any sense. The whole argument is just like wish casting.
Yeah, exactly. If it bleeds, it leads. So two people who agree with this guy, I'm making my own point here, Lloyd Blankfein and Jamie Dimon. And if you have to ask, don't bother. When they talk, I turn it off.
Do you remember who Kathy Ireland is?
Sure.
She was a supermodel, mm-hmm. Was on the cover of Sports Illustrated swimsuit mm-hmm. issue when I was in my teen years. So obviously a very famous and beautiful woman. She is suing her money managers for fumbling her multi-million dollar fortune. At one point estimated to be over $400 million.
Ooh.
She's claiming that through mismanagement, they're now broke.
Broke?
Or on the verge of being broke. The article is very light on details, but there's a lot of they didn't do this. I'm not even sure which side to come down on this argument, but it's going to play out in the courts over the next couple of years.
Well, what'd you do, put it in a blind trust? So they never had discussions about it along the way?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. These people were her managers since she was young, in her 20s, and now she's in her 40s or 50s, probably 50s.
Probably.
And did you just not notice?
It sounds like an absence of financial planning, which I would be remiss not
to
mention.
It does. So, yeah.
Including all the communication
the most important
that comes
step.
With it.
Yeah.
I just wonder how I just wonder about the validity of these things where – was she spending too much? Was she making bad investments? Was she you know, buying stuff for friends. I don't know.
Or was she getting robbed blind?
It's possible. All of those things are possible.
I'll look for any news on that for a while. Let's see if we learn anything.
It has a setup to be an interesting story. So
yeah, it does.
It just didn't have a lot of details except that she's very strong in her faith and can't believe that someone would do this to her. So who knows where that's going to come down.
Yeah, we'll have to see.
Yeah, I'm flabbergasted. Don't deal with people you meet at church, people.
You always say that.
Yeah, I do. Speaking of, well, you know why they are. They're not licensed with Series 7s or CFPs or anything like that. They sell mutual funds, and the license you have to get to sell a mutual fund is what's the simplest thing in the world, I would say. Anyway, mutual funds. I have a question for you. How would you guys react to a change in the tax law for mutual funds where if you got your dividend and reinvested it at the end of the year, you would not be taxed on it until you sold the
dividend
shares?
Or capital gains?
Both.
I mean, I think it would reignite interest in mutual
definitely
funds.
Capital gains, but I think they want to include both of them.
But right. So you mean like when mutual funds do capital gains distributions, it's no longer taxable? Because that's really the big distinction.
Tax deferred, then. In other words,
it's tax deferred. I mean, that's a big deal. That affects a lot of people every year. This time every year, we're looking at 1099s and explaining to people.
We've had a lot of conversation around that.
This is why we're moving to ETFs whenever we can, which is tricky because you got to realize a capital gain to avoid this capital gain distribution. There's a difference between the two. It's a lot for people to understand.
I had that conversation with a client yesterday.
Yep.
I'm trying to figure out exactly where I stand on it. It would be good for investors. It would be great for the mutual fund industry.
It would.
And I'm not sure how I feel about that compared to the ETFs.
I mean, you're still lacking the tradability of the ETF. Mm-hmm. It's still going to trade after hours at the end of the day. It's still less attractive overall to me.
That's true, and that's a good point, too.
I don't think there's any reason that these mutual fund companies, they're all opening ETFs anyway. Why don't we just move the industry there?
Yeah, and a lot of them are doing like these conversion options. They have these these events where they announce, hey, you can do a conversion from this window to this window, and it will not be taxable. The IRS signs off on it. And that's a great deal.
Because
you get the transition at really no cost.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room for improvement in the taxation for investors.
This might be unpopular in certain segments, but I don't think we need to prop up the mutual fund industry when we have a better vehicle available already.
Yeah, I've argued that on and off over the years, too. And when I started in this, it was, 2001, and there were a handful of ETFs. Maybe there were 100 or something like that.
Yeah.
And now, what is it, 15,000, 17,000 choices?
There's no way you could know all of the options. There's so many.
And then the number of mutual funds has shrunken accordingly. And it seems to me like investors are voting with their feet.
Exactly.
Definitely.
So do we need a change in the mutual fund industry to try to save their businesses for them? No. Although, and we talked about this a lot too, there are things that we do where we like the active management you find in a mutual fund.
But you can get actively managed ETFs now.
I know, and I have not seen enough about it to have a real good picture of how they're doing. Wait, you guys have any experience with them?
Yeah. I mean, PIMCO Income is now available as a ETF. And it's not 100% the same, but it's pretty close. And it has a lower cost per share, better tradability, and no cap gains.
Get the expertise of a good manager.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's where we should be going.
Yeah. There's really very few cases where at this point where like the mutual fund is a clear better wrapper for and even in the case that it feels that way, a lot of times what you see is just kind of a closed end fund approach where you have limited tradability for something like private credit, where you really don't want redemptions every day if you're trying to achieve what that fund
typically
should be trying to achieve.
You'll see those as an interval fund where you can trade at the end of a quarter.
Right. And that really makes sense and actually protects investors.
I also think that ETFs reduce market volatility. You know what happens when you sell a mutual fund, the only customer is the fund company. They have to buy it that day after the end of the market. Same thing when you buy. You buy it from them, nobody else. I can't buy one from Adam or Joey. I can't sell one to either of you. So what happens is that the big mutual fund companies, when they start getting redemptions or purchases in excess, they have to do some buying and selling that they might not want to do. But if I sold an identical ETF to you, say, this guy had to make redemptions, but this guy didn't, because you just take everything I own and give me money instead. And there's no buying or selling in the market. The number of shares on the float don't change. So to me, it protects you from excess volatility. Another reason to support the ETF.
Definitely. And there's probably listeners out here who may remember this. If you owned a bunch of mutual funds in 2007, 2008, after losing money and before the market recovery, you may have also in 2009 have been hit with a massive capital gains distribution related to the redemptions you're talking about, because the only buyer and traders are between you and the fund company.
Yeah.
And that liquidity squeeze creates a need to sell and generate taxes that passes through to those who held.
That's true.
And it's painful.
Thought that's sort of a second wave effect.
It is.
Well, these are good topics for discussion, because there's a push for all this stuff, but it's still very, very small in its infancy. But yeah, I'd like to know what my opinion is, and I get part of that from chatting with you guys and people in the office. All right, let's talk about Adam's going to take an airplane trip here pretty soon. And everybody knows that the government shutdown is impacting the TSA. Right?
Yeah, it's just not a full government shutdown, just Homeland Security.
Right. Well, they are losing a lot of agents, so it's going to make it worse because, you know, don't get paid. My idea, which is so radical, is why don't we privatize it? Like Atlantic City, Sonoma County, Dawson Community Airport, Great Falls International, Glacier Park, Greater Rochester International, Kansas City, Clayton Airport, Orlando Sanford, Portsmouth International, Punta Gorda Airport, Roswell International, San Francisco International. They're all privatized. See any problem with that? Go to any of those airports, you're not going to wait in a long line.
Really? So the San Francisco airport has privatized security?
Yep.
Or TSA?
Yep.
I didn't know that.
I did not.
Most people don't. I had heard that before. That's why I looked up the whole list this morning.
Yeah. I mean, some of those are really small regionals, so that makes sense. But
yeah.
San Francisco is not.
We'll be right back. Got to take a quick break. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Joey Loss.
And I remind everyone again, 904-222-8255, where we have Good Morning Greg.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Outstanding. And you?
It's a beautiful day today.
Isn't it?
And nice day to be out in the yard taking care of the weeds and things.
Good. What's on your mind?
Listening to the Van Wees.
Yeah, that's good. It kind of makes the time go by.
It helps the time go by and helps get over the drudgery of pulling weeds.
Yeah, it's not my favorite thing.
So I have a comment or a question, and then I'll take a stab at the trivia question.
Sure.
It seems like, I don't know if you guys knew this or not. I'm sure you did. You guys are pretty smart fellows. But it was about, 26 years ago, I think, yesterday, when the dot-com era popped in 2000. Mm-hmm. I think it was March 13th, 2000.
But it kind of went on from the 13th to the 19th, I think. But, yeah, there was one of those days was really bad.
Right. You're right. So my question or my comment is that this, we could see the selling in the market after the, for instance, the SPX topped at around 7,000, and it's been selling and selling, and you know, it's a couple days it go up, couple days go down, whatever. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is this. Do you, I get the feeling that the selling that's currently happening since, let's say, the end of February is not so much retail as it is institutional selling, just by the volume, the sheer volume of shares that are being transacted, and where the price of the S&P is now. Obviously, this what's going on in Iran doesn't help at all. So if the institutions are, and I think, you know, when you think about it, that the price is I think it officially broke down yesterday, but so someone's coming in and supporting it. I don't know if it's retail or who, but there was a lot of volume yesterday in the, in that market. So I'm curious as to what you think. If you think you guys had made a prediction at the end of the year, 2025, that you thought by the end of 2026 that the market would be higher. My question to you is this. Do you have any thoughts on how low the market, the S&P, for example, might go before it turns up higher? Do you have a figure there, or have you not given it much thought? What do you guys think about that?
I mean, it's a great question, but honestly, I haven't really given it a lot of thought. I think it's way too dependent on factors that are yet to be determined, the biggest one being the price of oil. If we stay, I said it at the beginning of the show, but if we see oil stay high longer, you're going to see the market go lower. If oil reverses and everything gets back to quote unquote normal, I think that you could see a relatively shallow dip.
Okay.
Joey, you want to contradict anything?
No, I don't contradict that at all. I think we're in a very unusual time. It's usually there's a myriad factors that are impacting the market at any given time, and it's unusual for us to be in a position of saying it's pretty much all oil today is what's driving it.
I don't even remember ever saying that, in fact.
Think the day we find out one of two things, either Iran did not bomb or did not put the mines in the Strait of Hormuz, or the day we go in there and say it's cleared and now ships are going to go, I think that's how low the S&P will go.
Okay.
And just to give an example of why that's so impactful is the longer oil stays high and the longer we're in this sort of interest rate spike that's a reversal of the downward trend we've seen for the last few years, the more cash is running out for small businesses and home building and things that seem kind of unrelated. But the more they start to run out of cash, the more you're starting to dry up liquidity in the system, and you start to see broader impact to the market. But just for context sake, we typically have about a 10% correction every year, and we're coming up on about a year since the last one.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean we're going to have one, but history would say you should expect probably a 10% correction at some point this year.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever that's worth.
Yeah, I hate to pin anything on one thing like that, but I think you guys are both right, that this is a 100% oil-driven phenomenon right at the moment.
Well, and I do want to say also it's the effects of higher oil. So you're seeing the 10-year spike, and that is directly related to the price of oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that, again, is not helping the market.
Right. But we got to get that situation cleared up over there.
It sounds like that you also consider – you know, historical cycles like what occurred about a year ago, what occurred 26 years ago.
Sure.
And if you go back even 52 years ago, back to 1974, you know where we were at then?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It was the Arab oil embargo.
Yep.
So it's interesting how these things seem to rhyme in the market. Don't ask me why. It just happens that way.
It's so true.
So, I'm going to take a stab that I think that the market is going to hit 5,000 this year. Let me not say this year, in a year. I think it's going to go there before we get better. But that's just my own 2 cents.
Okay.
And it's probably not even worth 2 cents.
You're on the record in my notes.
I got it down here, too.
Good.
Okay.
See, now, unlike most places, you have to be accountable for what you say around here.
Yeah. Yeah, when the market hits 5,000 and Adam spontaneously has a vacation so that I can deliver the bad news, I'll make sure to give Greg his tea that day.
That's funny.
Well, let me just say this. If it gets there, that's a great buying opportunity.
Oh,
but
we agree.
You know what happened 52 years ago as well? Colgate-Palmolive had posted their earnings, and it was far below expectations. You know who posted earnings this week, and it was also below expectations?
I don't.
Campbell Soup.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
they've been struggling for quite a while.
Yeah, they are. But you know what? It's at a 22-year low, and I bought some this week.
That's funny. I did see someone just ripping on Campbell's Soup on the news this week on the financial channel, just saying, look, they can't figure out how to sell highly salted water to Gen Z, and I don't think they ever will because they just don't want it. And I was laughing. It was
pretty good.
Obviously someone who was biased against them, but it was pretty funny.
If you put an avocado in that can, it'll start selling.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
We all grew up on it, and look at us. I don't know. Is that good news or bad news?
All right. Can I take a stab at the question?
But of course.
And I can tell you that I had a little help with this. So I'm going to say that it's Luxembourg.
Well, unfortunately, you are not correct.
Well, then I'm going to be listening to your show till the end.
You won't have to listen long. We're getting there.
Okay. All right.
Thanks.
Guys, take care.
You have a great one. Yeah, that's interesting, though. We don't really have time to get into it, so... The top five in order are Singapore, Switzerland, Ireland, Taiwan, and shockingly, Australia.
Hmm.
I never think of Australia or New Zealand as being economically free anymore. They've been taking the wrong turns for a long time. But this was brand new data. So,
what are some of the key underlying metrics that determine that?
Let's see. Gains in monetary freedom, government spending, fiscal health, and investment freedom have outpaced the lower score in trade freedom, reflecting the positive impact of major regulatory and tax reforms on economic growth, investment, and business confidence. By the way, we're up to number 22. We rose 5 points, I think, and we're 22nd in the world. And if that doesn't disgust you, I'm shocked. Let's see. Progress is not accidental. It reflects the Trump administration pragmatic pro-growth economic strategy. So they got it right. Argentina, a lot of you know that would...
They have to be up massively in the last few years.
They are up 40 places. Two, you want to guess?
It's still probably fairly low because they were really down there.
You got it.
I don't know, like 30th?
146th.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
Close.
They were
That's incredible.
They went up 40. Wow. Hmm. It's a score of 48.3, and ours is over 72.8.
Hmm.
So just interesting, I thought. All right, Joe's got a couple of tax reminders for people since it is that season.
Yeah, we're running out of time, so I'll hit these kind of rapid succession. Well, your filing date's coming up, I'm sure you know, and hopefully you're either in TurboTax or working with your accountant to get that sorted out. Tax deadline is April 15th. That is also your deadline for IRA or Roth IRA contributions. And I want to plug a reminder that if you have a high-deductible health plan and you're pre-age 65, you can also make HSA contributions. That's a good way to push down your tax liability for 2025, and you have until April 15th to do it. If you're an individual... You can put up to $4,300, and if you're on a family plan, you can put up to $8,550 for the year 2025. Your deadline for RMDs, if you turned 73 in 2025, is April 1st, 2026, that you have to take your first RMD by that date. If you did not take one last year, you'll also have to take a second one later in the year. Those are really the big ones. There's a couple other things that we can talk about and save for next week, but I just wanted to put those out there.
One of the big ones is tax scams. IRS will not call you. They will not email you. They'll send you a letter, and then you can start talking to them. So